From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We have 132,000 of our bravest troops stuck in the middle of a bloody civil war in Iraq, and I'd say it's high time we bring them home to the hero's welcome!
It's not just another anti-war rally. It's the victory speech of challenger Ned Lamont. He's won the Connecticut Democratic primary, beating Joe Lieberman. Did the longtime senator concede? Well, not quite.
If the people of Connecticut are good enough to send me back to Washington as an independent Democrat, I promise them I will keep fighting for the same progressive new ideas and for stronger national security. That's who I am.
Senator Lieberman will now run as an independent. We'll talk about the implications with another third-party presidential candidate, Ralph Nader. And we'll speak with another anti-war challenger, Jonathan Tessini, about why a Time Warner New York TV station is refusing to set up a debate between him and his opponent, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. And as the New York Times headlines a story, left or right, Israelis are pro-war, another Israeli soldier has been jailed for refusing to fight. We'll speak with his brother. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's considering a further expansion of its attack on Lebanon amidst a rising death toll and worsening humanitarian crisis. Israel's declared southern Lebanon a no-drive zone and has warned residents it'll bomb all moving vehicles. A leaflet dropped on Tuesday reads, quote, "Every car of any kind seen moving south of Litani will be targeted. All those who move in their cars are in danger." Within hours of Israel's threat, the United Nations said it would suspend aid deliveries to an estimated 100,000 civilians in South Lebanon. Aid agencies rejected Israel's assurances that deliveries would be granted safe passage. Christopher Stokes, the head of the Doctors Without Borders mission in Lebanon, said, quote, "For many days, the concept of humanitarian corridors has been used to mask the reality. It's impossible to get safe access to the villages in the south. We do not have real access to the people most in need," he said. Lebanon continues to suffer intense bombardment. Attacks earlier today killed at least 9 people, including 5 children. 2 people died and 15 were wounded in an Israeli strike on the Palestinian refugee camp of Ain al-Hilwa. It was the first time the camp has been hit in the current war. In Gaza, Israel bombed a funeral procession Tuesday for 14 people killed just the day before. 6 mourners died in the attack. In Abatia, 4 people were killed and 16 wounded when an Israeli airstrike destroyed several buildings. An unidentified witness described the attack.
"Israel bombed us. There were 20 people inside the house. 15 of them were injured and 4 dead, and one of them is seriously injured."
In Beirut, residents have set up a mock cemetery to honor the war's dead. On Tuesday, candles were placed next to hundreds of cement blocks symbolizing graves of the dead. The Lebanese death toll has been estimated as high as 1,000 people, mostly civilian. There have been increasing reports Israel is abducting civilians in South Lebanon. In Tyre, a 73-year-old man has been reunited with his family after what he says was 5 days in Israeli custody. The man, Ali Akil Hamza, described his ordeal.
"There were a lot of them, more than 200 troops. They took me and detained me in a house. They left me there without any food for 2 days. They asked me about my children, and I said, I don't know where they are. They said, either you get your children to come here, or we keep you here. I said, you could kill me, hang me, but I don't know where my children are."
In Jerusalem, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert held a cabinet meeting today to discuss expanding the attack on Lebanon. Hezbollah fired over 100 Katyusha rockets on northern Israel Tuesday, forcing the evacuation of thousands of people near the border. Meanwhile, 4 Israeli soldiers were killed in South Lebanon. On the diplomatic front, the U.S. and France have reportedly split over the terms of the UN resolution calling for a ceasefire. France is said to have agreed to incorporate Lebanon's demand for a Lebanese troop deployment alongside a UN-led force. Lebanon also wants Israel to withdraw from the Sheba Farms area captured in the 1967 war. The Bush administration's rejecting both demands. At the United Nations Tuesday, an Arab League delegation said Lebanon's being abandoned and that further violence could trigger an all-out civil war. Meanwhile, Lebanese acting foreign minister Tariq Mitri repeated his country's strong objections to the U.S.-backed resolution.
The resolution leaves Lebanon vulnerable to the whims of Israel. How could it be viable? How could a resolution provide for a cessation of hostilities and then, in fact, carry the great risk of continued violence and destruction?
In response, Israeli Ambassador Dan Gillerman said the issue is not whether the UN can pass a resolution, but whether it can agree on confronting Hezbollah.
The critical test this Council faces is not whether it can adopt a resolution. The question is whether this Council and the international community can adopt a course of action, a blueprint for change, which will end the threat that Hezbollah and its sponsors pose to the people of Israel and Lebanon and to the region as a whole.
Meanwhile, Israel's foreign minister is coming under criticism for her comments in a speech given by Lebanese Prime Minister Fouad Senyoura. Speaking before a gathering of Arab foreign ministers in Beirut Monday, Senyoura broke down and wept as he described the war's toll on Lebanese civilians. On Tuesday, Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni had this to say.
I also, Ms. Chairman, saw yesterday Senyoura crying, and we all cry for our dead, either in public or not in public, but this is the place to tell him to wipe his tears and to begin acting in order to produce a better future, more of a normal future, first of all for the civilians for which he cries.
Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni. She was speaking in front of the Israeli Knesset. Lebanon's environment minister is warning it could take up to 10 years for the Lebanese coastline to recover from a massive oil spill caused by the Israeli bombing of a power station. Environment Minister Yaqub Saraf told BBC News the spill has killed off massive stocks of fish and severely disrupted the ecosystem. Meanwhile, a UN-affiliated marine group issued a warning Tuesday that the oil spill could pose a cancer risk to Beirut's 2 million residents. The group, Infarak, calls the spill, quote, a high-risk toxic cocktail made up of substances which cause cancer and damage to the endocrine system. In the occupied territories, the Speaker of the Palestinian Parliament has been hospitalized after claiming he was abused by Israeli troops. Aziz Dwaik was seized on Saturday after Israeli soldiers surrounded his home in the West Bank. A spokesperson said Dwaik severely beaten. The Israeli army denies the claims. In Iraq, at least 35 people were killed and 60 wounded in violence that struck mostly Baghdad. A bombing near Iraq's interior ministry killed 10 people. Another 10 civilians were killed when a bombing ripped through a market in central Baghdad. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has lashed out at U.S. military raid that killed 3 civilians in Baghdad. In a televised statement, Maliki said he was very angered and pained and vowed it wouldn't happen again. Meanwhile, a U.S. Black Hawk helicopter has crashed in Anbar province. At least 2 soldiers are missing. Several Iraqi journalists are accusing U.S. and Iraqi troops of assaulting them as they reported from Kirkuk. The journalists told Al Jazeera they've been physically beaten, had their equipment confiscated, and been accused of terrorism. One reporter said he believes the assaults are intended to stop journalists reporting properly on rising levels of violence. The U.S. military says it's investigating. In Sri Lanka, government and rebel forces are each taking credit for the reopening of a water canal at the center of 2 weeks of fighting. Over 400 have been killed and thousands displaced as Tamil Tiger rebels have battled Sri Lankan forces in Trincomalee. Here in the United States, three-term Senator Joseph Lieberman lost Connecticut's Democratic primary last night, one of the most closely watched races in the country. He was defeated by Ned Lamont, a wealthy telecommunications executive who's run largely on an anti-Iraq war platform. Lamont won with 52% of the vote to Lieberman's 48%. Voter turnout was nearly twice the norm for a primary. Lieberman now says he'll run as an independent. We'll have more on that coverage after headlines. Meanwhile, in Georgia, former DeKalb County Commissioner Hank Johnson has declared victory over Congressmember Cynthia McKinney in the Democratic primary runoff. Johnson finished with 58% of the vote. McKinney took 41%. After polls opened Tuesday, McKinney's campaign claimed there were several voting irregularities, including insecure machines and the absence of McKinney's name on the ballot in at least one precinct. Could U.S. officials be charged with war crimes? The Bush administration appears to be taking the possibility seriously. According to the Washington Post, the Bush administration has drafted amendments to the 1996 War Crimes Act. The law criminalizes violations of the Geneva Conventions and threatens the death penalty to U.S. officials if U.S.-held detainees die in custody from abusive treatment. The White House is proposing changes that would narrow the scope of punishable offenses. The new list would exclude humiliating or degrading treatment of prisoners. Military law experts believe the Bush administration is effectively rewriting parts of the Geneva Conventions. Meanwhile, Democratic Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid is calling for the resignation of Veterans Affairs Secretary Jim Nicholson following the loss of yet another computer holding the personal data of tens of thousands of veterans. On Monday, the Department of Veterans Affairs said a desktop computer containing private data of about 38,000 veterans had gone missing. This follows a missing computer that had more than 26 million names and the data, the private data, of veterans. And finally, in Japan, the city of Nagasaki is marking the 61st anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombing. Earlier today, dignitaries gathered for a service at Nagasaki's Peace Park. Survivor Kikuyo Nakamura was among those to speak.
The beautiful city of Nagasaki was destroyed in a flash by a single bomb dropped by the United States. We commemorate this day to wish that Nagasaki will be the last city ever to suffer a nuclear bomb and that there will be a peaceful world without nuclear weapons or wars.
A moment of silence was held at 11:02 a.m. Japan time, the moment the bomb was dropped. Over 200,000 people died in the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Three-term Senator Joseph Lieberman lost Connecticut's Democratic primary last night in one of the most closely watched races in the country. He was defeated by Ned Lamont, a wealthy telecommunications executive who's run largely on an anti-war platform. Lamont won with 52% of the vote to Lieberman's 48%. Voter turnout was close to 40%, nearly twice the norm for a primary. The race drew national attention as a measure of public sentiment over the Iraq War. Lieberman's only the fourth incumbent senator to lose his party's nomination since 1980. His loss comes just 6 years after he was the Democratic Party's vice presidential candidate in 2000. He's been harshly criticized for his vocal support of the Iraq War and his continued opposition to an immediate U.S. troop withdrawal. He's also been taken to task for his perceived closeness to President Bush and other Republicans. Lieberman publicly conceded the Democratic primary Tuesday night shortly after 11 p.m. He promised his supporters to run for a fourth term as an independent candidate.
Tomorrow morning, our campaign will file the necessary petitions with the Connecticut Secretary of State's office so that we can continue this campaign for a new politics of unity and purpose. If the people of Connecticut are good enough to send me back to Washington as an independent Democrat. I promise them I will keep fighting for the same progressive new ideas and for stronger national security. That's who I am.
Senator Lieberman speaking to his supporters Tuesday night. To run as an independent, he must file petitions with 7,500 valid signatures by the end of today. Ned Lamont will face Republican Alan Schlesinger in November, a former state legislator seen as little threat. In his victory speech, Lamont said he would push for withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq.
We have 132,000 of our bravest troops stuck in the middle of a bloody civil war in Iraq, and I'd say it's high time we bring them home to the hero's welcome. It's time we fix George Bush's failed foreign policy. President Kennedy said it so well. It was President Kennedy who said, we never negotiate from fear, but we should never be afraid to negotiate. As your senator, I'm going to make sure we have the strongest army on the face of this earth, but I also know that America is strongest when we work in concert with our allies, when we stay true to our values, and we deal with the rest of the world with respect. With respect.
Ned Lamont, Democratic Senate candidate for Connecticut, speaking last night, his victory address. As we turn now to Ralph Nader. He was an independent candidate for president. You have welcomed Joseph Lieberman to the ranks of third parties, Ralph Nader.
Yes, I think that his entry as an independent candidate will diminish some of the chronic opposition by the Democrats to anybody who expresses their First Amendment right and runs as an independent or a third-party candidate, like a Green candidate.
Can you talk about the success of Ned Lamont? Talk about this whole campaign as you speak to us today from Connecticut.
Well, I think it's a testament to word of mouth, Amy. This whole campaign started without any expose, without any major 60-minute program, without any ecological disaster that the Democrats have ignored. It started in small towns around the state with people talking to one another in the post office, meeting in living rooms. And that developed an aura of possibility that caught the attention of Ned Lamont. And of course, it helped that he had a lot of money to spend, and he had some good campaign managers. But basically, it's a testament to the power of the word of mouth, which historically has always been the generic source of progressive movements, whether it was in the farmer populist days or in the labor union organizing days. And I think that's the message throughout the country for progressives. It certainly, this Lamont victory is certainly going to give a lot of morale boost to beleaguered progressives in the Democratic Party to try their hand at challenging incumbents or running for various offices at the local, state, and national level. And I think in New York State, it should bring more people to rally to Cassini's campaign against Hillary Clinton in the Senate Democratic primary there. I expect to see some activists and celebrities, maybe Jesse Jackson, maybe a number of others around the country now, to come to his candidate's support.
Ralph Nader, Jesse Jackson wrote a piece in the Chicago Sun-Times saying, Joe Lieberman has been in the Senate for 18 years. He's a leader of the Democratic Leadership Council. the money wing of the party. He became the party's vice presidential nominee, even as he championed the DLC's triangulating politics, pushing off of the Democratic Party base to demonstrate his independence by embracing key elements of the conservative agenda, championing the war in Iraq, attacking affirmative action, pushing capital gains tax cuts that benefit only the very wealthy. Can you talk about Senator Lieberman saying, while he differed, while he agreed with the Bush administration over the Iraq war, that he has been, that he has taken a progressive stance on many other issues?
Well, Senator Lieberman would have lost even bigger last night if Lamont's people actually expanded their criticism of Senator Lieberman as big business's favorite Democratic senator, not just George Bush's favorite Democratic senator. The most aggressive, cruel, and insensitive business lobby and the most powerful in Washington is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And they have enthusiastically endorsed Senator Joseph Lieberman, one of only two Democratic senators they've endorsed out of 46 Democratic senators. And they have given him the highest cumulative score in their ranking of any Democratic senator in the Northeast, and for good reason. He has supported the U.S. Chamber of Commerce positions, not only on capital gains cuts, tax. He supported NAFTA and WTO and CAFTA, which have depleted jobs here, high-paying jobs here in Connecticut. He has supported the Chamber's drive to weaken the rights of injured workers and consumers and defrauded investors from having their full day in court against the perpetrators of their misery. He has supported the Exxon-Cheney energy bill, that notorious energy bill that was signed into law last year, that subsidized big oil's profiteering, weakened environmental standards in a variety of ways, and made sure that there were no further advances in fuel efficiency for motor vehicles. And here in Connecticut, like everywhere else, they're paying $3.40, $3.50 a gallon, and it's going up. So he hasn't done anything on that. And then finally, on the labor issue, he's not been outspoken on the minimum wage like Senator Kennedy. He has not pushed for labor law reform to give workers a chance to organize. He has not gone after OSHA because of its weak enforcement of the occupational safety and health laws. 58,000 American workers die every year, according to OSHA, from worker-related diseases and trauma. So in many, many ways, including never challenging the military budget, that's the Chamber of Commerce position as well, never really in 18 years advancing universal health insurance, that's a Chamber of Commerce provision. So, you know, the question I asked Joe Lieberman is he going to repudiate publicly the Chamber of Commerce's endorsement and campaign support, lots of money from businesses into his campaign, and is he going to challenge the Chamber of Commerce's drive all over the United States in hundreds of campaigns, working overtime to undermine his own Democratic Party and its more progressive candidates? Well, calls to four Lieberman offices in Washington, Connecticut last week received no answer to the question, Joe Lieberman, are you going to reject the Chamber of Commerce's endorsement of you? So he goes around, including this morning, saying he's a progressive Democrat, a progressive independent Democrat. So I think the struggle is going to be between the progressive Democrats and the corporate Democrats, who for years have dominated the party and has had Joe Lieberman as one of their charter members.
We're talking to Ralph Nader, himself an independent presidential candidate in 2004. Now Joseph Lieberman says he'll run against the Democratic Party's pick for Senator of Connecticut. Again, Ned Lamont has won the Democratic primary in Connecticut, a case that is a primary that has been closely watched around the country. When we come back from break, Ralph Nader will stay with us and we'll be joined by Jonathan Tessini. He's challenging Hillary Rodham Clinton here in New York for her Senate seat. Stay with us.
Election time's coming. Who you gonna vote for? Yeah. If I was president, I'd get elected on Friday, assassinated on Saturday, buried on Sunday, they go back to work on Monday. If I was president, if I was president, if I was president too. Instead of spending billions on the war, I can use that money so I can feed the poor. Cause I know some so poor. When it rains, that's when they shower, scream and fight the power. That's when the vulture devours. If I was president, I'd get elected on Friday, assassinated on Saturday, buried on Sunday. They go back to work on Monday. If I was president, if I was president, if I was president, yeah. I know some soldiers that sleep but they can't dream. Wake up with screams, sounds of M16. So take this medal of honor for your bravery. I wish you the best, kid. You and your family. If I was president.
If I Were President by Wycliffe Jean, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Connecticut primary race is seen as a measure of voter sentiment around the Iraq War, and it's being watched around the country. Perhaps no place more than right here in New York, where Democracy Now! Broadcasts from, with New York Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, as Lamont gained in popularity and clearly looked like he was moving towards victory. Hillary Rodham Clinton was becoming more talkative about the Iraq War. Last week at the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing, she questioned Rumsfeld and said that she thought he should resign. Senator Lieberman said he had said that 2.5 years ago. Well, we are staying on the line right now from Connecticut with Ralph Nader, an independent presidential candidate in 2004. Again, Joseph Lieberman has announced he will run for the Senate seat that he has held for 18 years as an independent against Ned Lamont and the Republican. And we're joined in our New York studio by Jonathan Tessini. He is challenging Hillary Rodham Clinton for her Senate seat. We invited Hillary Rodham Clinton on today's broadcast. Her office did not respond to our call. Jonathan Tessini, Ralph Nader just mentioned the issue of money. How do you compare yourself to Ned Lamont, who just won in Connecticut?
Well, I'm not a multimillionaire, that's for sure. Ned Lamont was, I guess, fortunate enough to have been a cable executive, was able to spend more than $4 million of his own money. We rely on individual donors and small donors all across the state and, frankly, all across the country. And I think that's really the essence of democracy. One of the things that wasn't pointed out, and I think, you know, Ralph pointed out before, it's not an inconsequential thing in this victory that Ned Lamont was able to spend $4 million. That's the way you get on television. That's the way you can advertise. But we've had an amazing grassroots campaign that got us on the ballot. So I'm very proud of the kind of campaign we've been running.
I wanted to ask you about the coverage of your campaign and read a quote. The local Time Warner station in New York, New York One, has refused to set up a debate between you and Senator Clinton because you haven't spent enough money in your campaign. We invited New York One to join us on today's program, but they declined. The station's public relations manager, Edward Pacetti, though, sent us this statement outlining their position. He said, New York One News is producing the most ambitious series of political debates and town hall meetings this election season. As part of the staging of these events, New York One established criteria to identify which candidates would be invited to participate in these events. The criteria are that a candidate must poll at least 5%, including margin of error, in a recognized independent poll and would need to have spent and or raised $500,000. All candidates who have met these criteria have been invited to participate. That's the statement of New York One, which is owned by Time Warner. What are your poll numbers, Jonathan Tessini?
Well, we're actually at 13%, which is pretty extraordinary. That's actually the number that Ned Lamont was at several months ago when Joe Lieberman was leading that race by 55 points. And the reason we're, I think, at that number is we've had an amazing grassroots campaign. To get on the ballot in New York, which is one of the most difficult states to get on the ballot, you need 15,000 signatures. We were able to gather 40,000, which means that we have an enormous amount of support from the grassroots. And I find that criteria that New York One is putting out is appalling. It is anti-democratic. It amounts to essentially censorship. It takes and values money over the power of people and grassroots. I hope that New York One changes mind. We actually ask your listeners and your viewers to call New York One. You can go to our website, TicciniForNewYork.org, and get all that information. But we need to pressure New York One now to hold a debate between myself and Hillary Rodham Clinton, because voters deserve to see our position side by side before they go to the ballot box.
Now, interestingly, New York One's parent company, which is Time Warner, has contributed as one of the top contributors to Hillary Rodham Clinton's campaign. Contributed what? $100,000, was number six of the top 10.
Yes, that's correct. It's amazing.
Newsday today also, in an editorial comment, says that New York One should reconsider its criteria. You've been dealing with this for years, Ralph Nader. Your response?
I think the Time Warner Corporation should be in trouble under the 1934 Communications Act. I know that Time Warner owns over-the-air radio and TV stations. And New York One is a cable, Amy? Is it a cable station?
Yes, New York One is cable in New York.
So overall, this company's responsible under the 1934 Communications Act to perform in the public interest, necessity, and convenience. Those are the words in the act. And for this corporation, whose executives are giving to Hillary Rodham Clinton money, to have a means test to say that Johnson Tessini has to raise $500,000. Do you know that you have to raise only one-third of that running for president in order to qualify for matching funds under the federal law? And so they put the bar very high. They should have no right as a corporation, which is not a human being, not a person, to determine that kind of access. The only criteria that's justifiable is whether the candidate is on the ballot. If the candidate is a ballot-qualified candidate, that should bring that person into any of the debates.
I completely agree with Ralph, and in fact, the League of Women Voters has a debate scheduled on September 6th, which I've agreed to attend and Hillary Clinton has not. And the criteria they're using is exactly what Ralph says, which is getting on the ballot, which in fact in New York State is a very difficult thing. And I want to say, I don't even think the polling number is the right way to go. Their criteria in New York One is 5%, I'm at 13%. But if somebody came to the debate and was running as another candidate in this race, I would stand up for their right, if they were legally on the ballot, to be in this debate, whether they had 5% or not, whether they'd raise $500,000, because democracy is about the ability to go out there, talk to people, get them to sign your petitions. It's an amazing grassroots effort, and I think, frankly, that the Clinton campaign does not want to debate us. Putting aside for New York, the New York One issue just for a moment, I call on Hillary Clinton to agree to the set of debates that we've proposed in a letter just a couple of weeks ago. I'm happy to debate her on this program, anywhere that she would agree to do that. I think we should debate multiple times on the Iraq War, on the Middle East, on her relationships to corporate power, her support for free trade agreements like NAFTA. The voters deserve to know where she stands. She cannot run and hide from the voters in New York.
She called for Rumsfeld's resignation this past week.
Yes, but that's like, you know, that's like hitting a piñata. That was easy. What I hope the debate in this election comes down to the following. Whether the war was run ineffectively, inefficiently, which is her argument, and whether this war should have happened or not. Because I believe the voters will then support my position, which is this war was illegal and immoral. We should have withdrawn immediately. Not Hillary Clinton's position, which is essentially, well, we should have had 500,000 troops there or bombed Iraq even harder. That's her argument, that the Bush administration has bungled this war. I hope we get to debate the differences on that issue.
Have you seen her changing as a result of the Connecticut primary?
Well, there's no question that she took the attempt, but she challenge Rumsfeld because of the race in Connecticut. And let's remember, Bill Clinton crossed the border to go campaign for Joe Lieberman. Remember, Joe Lieberman was the man who came to the Senate floor and condemned Bill Clinton for his affair with Monica Lewinsky. There's no love lost between them. The only reason that Bill Clinton crossed this border to go to Connecticut was this race here in New York, because they worry that I am where the voters are. And I know that from the polling. I know that from talking to people in the streets, that the majority of voters support my position, not Hillary Clinton's.
And of course, beyond your position here in New York, if Hillary Rodham Clinton has her eye on the presidency in terms of the whole country and the sentiment around it.
Also, I might add, Amy, there needs to be a debate on the war in Iraq and on the war in Lebanon after the primary. And I'm sure that New York One and the Democratic politicos are going to try to freeze out third-party anti-war candidates like Howie Hawkins of the Green Party from Syracuse, who is running against Hillary Rodham Clinton for the U.S. Senate, a very accomplished civic organizer, a teamster, a writer, and just the kind of person who can present, after the primary's over, a continuation of this public debate. So I really hope that people in New York State will rise up for a vigorous debate and not give Hillary Rodham Clinton a free ride.
Jonathan Tessini, what about the war in Lebanon? What is your view right now on the conflict?
Well, just a little background for your viewers. My father was born in what was then Palestine, fought in the Israeli underground. A cousin of mine was killed in the 1973 war. My step-grandfather was murdered by a Palestinian who was taking revenge for the massacre that Baruch Goldstein conducted against the Muslim worshippers that very day. So I felt the cost of war in a very personal way. And I have been very saddened by Israel's response. I believe Hezbollah did break the law, international law, and at the same time, I think that the Israeli response was, particularly the bombing campaign in Beirut, was disproportionate. I often hearken back, startlingly enough, to Ariel Sharon, who, when the Israeli businessman was kidnapped some time ago, rather than conduct a war, he actually engaged in negotiations and freed prisoners that Israel had kept, and there was no war between Hezbollah and Israel at the time. Why could we not negotiate? And the United States was the only country that did everything possible to prevent a ceasefire. Condoleezza Rice was sent by George Bush to Rome to scuttle that ceasefire. And Hillary Rodham Clinton stopped just short of saying, let the bombs fall. She abrogated her responsibility as a leading figure in the Democratic Party, and I believe fanned the flames of violence in the Middle East.
Ralph Nader, you're a Lebanese American.
Well, first I want to say I've rarely seen a more compassionate and brave candidate for public office in this country on this issue than Jonathan Tessini. And he needs to be not only commended, but supported for this. He represents the best of the peace movement in our country. Given the background and that he's just described, he could very easily have become a hawk. Second, I think this is a massive high-tech terror war by the Israeli government against innocent Lebanese people and their livelihood and infrastructure. Hezbollah was engaged in a number of skirmishes with the Israeli army over the last 6 years. Israel, of course, violated the Lebanese border far more airily and navally and land than Hezbollah did. But that lethal skirmish was turned into a catastrophic war by the Israeli government against the innocent, defenseless people of Lebanon in three stages of state terrorism. First, direct strikes against residential areas, against wheat silos, against highways, water systems, power stations, hospitals, schools, vehicles fleeing with refugees. We've seen it all on TV. The second stage of Israeli state terrorism is deliberately impeding the rescue of the injured people, bombing, for example, ambulances on their way to the hospital, cutting off roads, preventing medical supplies and hospital workers from reaching the terrified injured and the remnants of the bleeding families. We saw Doctors Without Borders trying to manually convey across the Litani River after the last bridge was destroyed, medical supplies. And the third stage of Israeli state terrorism is direct strikes against rescue workers or injured people. For example, hitting at hospitals, ambulances, medical supplies, etc. You know, these are not just impeding rescue by blockading the whole country, which has now only 6 days left of fuel, including hospitals, but also going after rescue operations. So I would recommend, in addition to a ceasefire, in addition to withdrawal of combatants, in addition to an international peace force, I'd recommend an immediate international rescue operation, because thousands of people are going to die and get sick and get injured from the consequences of what has already been done in Lebanon and the blockade of any entry of supplies. It's hard to find a situation anywhere in the country, in the world, where after the devastation by one all-powerful party to a conflict of innocent civilians and their entire public services throughout a defenseless country, that this powerful agent anywhere in the world would be allowed to block relief efforts. And that's what has to be done right now, relief efforts. It's not enough that Israel has created an environmental disaster by blowing up oil depots that have contaminated the entire coast of Lebanon. But they also blew up 400 little fishing boats in a port north of Beirut and destroyed the livelihood of these people. So we really have to ask ourselves, in settling the core problem between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and that is what the core problem is. If that was settled, you wouldn't hear about Hezbollah. Who is the most powerful of the adversaries? Who is the occupier and the colonizer of whose land? And who has the all-out support of the most powerful country in the world, the U.S. government? And we know the answers to that. It's Israel. And it's Israel who should have responded in June, as Gideon Levy pointed out and others in Haaretz, to the agreement between Hamas and Fatah, the Palestinian arm, who agreed to seek a permanent settlement with the Israeli government in terms of a two-state solution.
We're going to go to Israel in a minute. We're going to hear from people who are refusing to serve in the Israeli military. But Jonathan Tessini, 10 seconds, last comment.
Well, there's an enormous amount of violence in the region. We need a ceasefire. There have been civilian casualties on all sides, and it's horrifying. It must stop. I'm going to continue arguing the points in this campaign. I urge people to help us and support our campaign. You can go to our website, TassiniForNewYork.org, T-A-S-I-N-I for New York.org.
And we will link at democracynow.org. Jonathan Tessini, thank you for joining us. New York senatorial candidate in the Democratic primary. He is taking on Hillary Rodham Clinton. Ralph Nader, former independent presidential candidate, speaking to us from Connecticut. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.
وقفوني على حدود قلب الدن هويتي قلت لهم إن بيافا خباية هستي وقفوني على حدود قلب الدن هويتي قلت لهم إن بيافا خباية هستي ويا كلمة القلتة تقصم وصف عين صف بكرة بيجو صف يسأل وين ويا كلمة القلتة تقصم وصف عين صف بكرة بيجو صف يسأل وين.
Marcel Khalifa, The Border, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel is considering a further expansion of its attack on Lebanon amidst a rising death toll and humanitarian crisis. And opponents of the war in Israel have become increasingly vocal. Despite a New York Times article that says, from left to right, Israel is pro-war. More than 100 demonstrations have taken place across Israel since the fighting began last month. Over 5,000 protesters marched in Tel Aviv last Saturday in one of the largest demonstrations in Israel since the attacks began. Protesters called on Israel to negotiate with Hezbollah and encouraged Israeli soldiers to disobey orders in Lebanon. Meanwhile, the Guardian newspaper has reported at least two Israeli fighter pilots have deliberately missed bombing targets in Lebanon because they were concerned they were bombing civilians. Guardian also reported a senior commander who's been involved in air attacks on Lebanon has raised concerns that the Air Force's actions might be considered war crimes. Yonatan Shapira is with us on the line from Israel. He's a former captain in the Israeli Air Force Reserve. In 2003, Yonatan initiated a group of Israeli Air Force pilots who refused to fly attack missions that might risk civilian populations in the Palestinian territories. He's co-founder of the group Combatants for Peace. Yonatan's brother refused to serve in Lebanon and earlier this week was sent to jail. We welcome you back to Democracy Now! Yonatan Shapira was in New York in the last few weeks, and we had him on Democracy Now! Welcome, Yonatan.
Good morning. The line is not so good, but I can hear you.
What's happened to your brother?
I can't hear you now.
What has happened to your brother? Can you...
The line is not working.
Can you tell us about your brother?
Yeah, if you can hear me, my brother just entered to jail yesterday afternoon after telling his commander, after asking him why he refused to go to Lebanon. My brother told him that he's doing so for the security of the citizens of Israel. And my brother is also a member of Combatants for Peace, and by now we have two members of our organization sitting in jail for refusing to participate in this war in Lebanon. Until five total, the total number of refusings that are sitting in jail for refusing to go to Lebanon are five, and we have many who are waiting for trials and waiting for being sent to jail.
We're also joined on the phone by Dan Tamir. He is with the Israeli peace group Yesh Gvul, a group that supports soldiers who refuse military assignments. He's an intelligence officer with the Israeli Defense Force Reserves. We welcome you to Democracy Now! From Jerusalem.
Good morning, New York. Good morning, Democracy.
It is very good to have you with us. You're an intelligence officer with the Israeli Defense Force Reserves. Are you going to serve in this war with Lebanon?
Well, until now, I have not been called personally to take part in this war, and I hope I won't be called personally. But there were many other officers and soldiers who were called to this war. And as Yonatan said before, many have said that they are not going to take part in what they see as an unnecessary bloodshed.
What would it mean if you refused?
Well, I have already twice told my commanders that I'm not willing to carry out such mobilization orders. The first time was in 2001 and the second time in 2004. That time it was considering going into military regime at the occupied territories in Judea and Samaria. I refused twice, and I was sent twice to jail for 1 month every time. Although it doesn't have to be like this, some people just say we are not going, and the commanders just let them go. I must emphasize it maybe that going to jail is not some kind of an aim for itself. Some people are sent to jail, but many others are being just dismissed. This is why the actual number of refuseniks, of people who refuse to take actions, is actually much higher than the number of people actually sitting in jail.
What do you mean?
I mean, there are many people, many soldiers and officers who say, we are not going. And since the Israeli military is doesn't have the strongest disciplines, many people are just being dismissed by their officers, telling them, okay, don't come this year, we'll call you in a few months, just in order not to make such a big fuss out of this whole issue.
Are you willing to go to jail again?
Well, if I would be again given any kind of an order to do things I find illegal, immoral, and useless, I would rather go to jail rather than do such things which are contradicting the basic interest of the State of Israel.
Do you have an estimate of the numbers of soldiers or people in the reserves who are saying no?
Well, I can give you a few fixed numbers. Since the beginning of the Second Intifada, that means in the last 5 years, we had at least 160 people who were refusing and were sent to jail. We know about many others who declared their refusal but were not sent to any kind of incarceration or imprisonment. And we assume there are many, many others who found all kinds of excuses, beginning with physical problems, medical problems, and ending with psychological problems or any kind of other excuses not to go into military service. So I estimate it in a few thousands, maybe even more.
Yonatan Shapira, You are a former captain in the Israeli Air Force Reserves, your brother now in jail, jailed this week. There's an article in the New York Times today, very sweeping article, headlined, Left or Right, Israelis Are Pro-War. Your response?
Yeah, first of all, it's very sad that indeed the majority of Israel is now supporting the war. I think there are many reasons for that. Probably people are in some condition of being fear-stricken by the institutions. They don't get all the information. The media here is very, very biased. They don't see what you can see in the Amy Goodman show in New York. Many thousands of kilometers from the Middle East, they see mostly what the Israeli military propaganda and the Israeli government wants them to see. And it's very sad, and I think this is part of the reason that we see this kind of support. But it's important for me to say that, for example, last Saturday, we were 10,000 people in the center of Tel Aviv, demonstrating together, Jews and Arabs, together shouting that we refuse to be enemies, and we were we are going to do another demonstration next Saturday in front of the jail where my brother and his friends are sitting. And I'm inviting all the international media to see what these people and the resistance in Israel to this war is doing. I can tell you some facts and some things that happened also within the Air Force, if you are interested.
Go ahead.
I just spoke to some friends in the Air Force, F-16 pilot, and he told me an interesting thing. He told me that since the third day of this war, they are waiting for Bush to stop the war. They also understand that they are playing some kind of role in this whole big war of interest between major forces, not just Israel and not just Hezbollah. He is also, he tells me that they are not counting anymore on the intelligence. Sometimes they see, they get the coordinates and they see a house in their target and they prefer to shoot beside the house because they don't know. Maybe there are civilians, maybe there are innocent people sitting there. And sometimes this intelligence are being based on the fact that Israel told those civilians to evacuate their villages, and then afterwards they just tell the pilots to bomb some houses then. And I know that more and more pilots are feeling very, very uncomfortable with this situation. And we are waiting for the first pilot to refuse to do these crimes and to help us, Israelis and Arabs in this region, to stop this crazy war.
Now, Yonatan Shapira, this is very significant, what the Guardian newspaper was talking about and also quoting you about this. At least two Israeli fighter pilots deliberately missing bombing targets in Lebanon because they were concerned they were being ordered to bomb civilians.
Yeah, I know that. I guess there are several of them. I spoke with one of them who told me, especially one case that he just got a target. Was a house on a hill, and he just didn't want to shoot at the house, and he shot beside the house. And later on, the commanders told him that it's okay. And my question is, if they can give pilots targets, and later on, when the pilot is not shooting the house and telling him that it's okay, you know, what is all this idea behind those missions? If you can shoot a house, you can not shoot a house. I think this. Very, very problem, feeling behind all this mission that these pilots are getting. And just so you know, a pilot, I'm not a fighter pilot. I was a helicopter pilot, and I didn't shoot anyone. But I know, just like most of the people can understand, a fighter pilot is flying up in the sky, thousands of feet above the ground. He cannot see people. He cannot see. He can maybe see some dots, some things on the screen inside the cockpit, but he cannot know whether there are civilians, there are enemies, there are the track is bringing missiles or bringing kids. And if now we see that pilots cannot trust the system, I think it's a sign that maybe in the near future. Some of them will speak out, not just quietly and continue to stir, but speak out to the world and help us to stop this war.
Yonatan Shapira, you come from an Air Force family, from an Air Force neighborhood in a suburb of Tel Aviv. What is the response? I mean, your father served, your brother's now one of them in jail.
You know, it's really, really not easy to be now in Israel against the war. My family, near to Tel Aviv, my parents' house is full with two families that came from the north, one from Haifa and one from a village next to Nahariya, where they were hit by Katyusha in their garden. And all these people are, given shelter in the center and are waiting for this war to be end. And I know that also some of them understand that this war is not going to end if we don't do something about that. And although the majority, as you just mentioned, is against us, is against the resistance in Israel and in favor of the war, we must do it also for these people, because they don't have all the information, they don't have the possibility to see the reality as.
I want to thank you both for being with us, Dan Tamir, activist with Yesh Gvul, and Yonatan Shapira, one of the co-founders of Combatants for Peace. His brother this week was jailed for refusing to fight in the Lebanon war. This is Democracy Now! As we wrap up in Nagasaki. It's the 61st anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombing today, August 9th. Earlier today, dignitaries gathered for the service at Nagasaki's Peace Park, a moment of silence at 11:02 a.m. Japan time, the moment the bomb was dropped. Over 200,000 people died in the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We turn now to a survivor of the atomic bombing of Nagasaki. At the time of the explosion, Saku Shimohira was in an air raid shelter a kilometer from the epicenter. She was 10 years old. She spoke recently at a rally in New York Central Park.
Suddenly, I felt a blinding flash. It was too enormous and intense to describe. Just a flash.
その時, 爆風が吹いて, 私たちは その爆風のために吹き飛ばされてしまいました. 妹は防空壕の隅っこに, 1歳のおいは畳の下敷きになっていました.
Next, the blast blew us off. When I regained consciousness, I found my younger sister in the corner of the shelter, and my nephew under the tatami mat.
松田のおばさんが全身真っ黒焦げになった体で喉に大きな一文字の傷を負って黒焦げの親子をしっかりと抱いて防空壕に転げ込んできました.
Auntie Matsuda blackened all over her body, with her baby also shared in arms, arrived and collapsed. She had a big open wound on her throat.
8歳の妹が水をくれって言うので、おばさんにその水を飲ませましたら、おばさんの喉からその水はタラタラタラタラとこぼれていきました。
We gave her water while she was drinking it. Water was also streaming out of her open wound.
おばさんは、ああ、美味しかったよ。 ありがとうと言って息を引き取りました。
She said, "It tasted so good. Thank you," and died.
私の兄も死にたくない、死にたくないと泣きながら、黄色い汚いものを口からいっぱい吐き出しながら死んでいきました。
My brother too, vomiting yellow matter and crying, "I don't want to die." And he died.
母は近所のうちで真っ黒焦げになって死んでいました。姉は自宅の中から遺体が黒焦げの遺体が見つかりました。
Both my mother and my eldest sister were found dead and shared around our house.
Atomic bombing survivor Sakushima Hira. She was 10 years old when the bomb was dropped on Nagasaki. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.